This is The Takeaway from Monday, June 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We're broadcasting this hour from member station WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Here in Orlando, throughout the country and around the world, people will take a moment to reflect and to remember those lost during the brutal attack last year at the Pulse nightclub. This day will be filled with the ringing of bells, the reading of names, the moments of silence, the makeshift memorials. This mass shooting left 49 dead and more than 50 others wounded. It was the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. The majority of the victims and survivors young, queer, and Latino. In my long career as a reporter, there have been so many of these memorials around the world. The bombed Marine barracks in Lebanon, Oklahoma City, Fort Hood, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, 9/11, Columbine, all collective moments of grief and tragedy that call upon the voices of everyone in a community to call out in pain and love for much longer than a moment, moments that change communities forever. It's what we found here in the land of make-believe, Orlando, Disney fantasy, strip mall prosperity. A troubled young man with access to guns put on a terrorist mask and began shooting.
How could one person do that much evil to young people that had their whole life ahead of them?
Or young Caitlin Cruz and her older brother, Irwin, who believe their lives will be worse than mine for all of this.
Every single month, it's almost like there's a tragedy going on. And so if we don't kind of spread that love, because love can only cure this, I just think it's getting worse and worse, and we need more acceptance around here and more of that love to make everything better.
There's a tension between the randomness of the victims in places like this and the specificity of the attacker. It's a curious tension. It makes these places seem similar and completely different.
Just because the world is losing sanity doesn't mean that we have to. You know, I don't think it's cynical at all. I think it's awareness. You know, the more we talk about it, the more we can, you know, diagnose the root problem and actually do something, you know, about it.
Here on this street corner, a feeling of contradictions and a spirit of brotherhood, of bonding, of people hugging and trying to come together.
I just wanted to come out and pay my respects and remember what happened a year ago. I think a year ago I wasn't ready. I didn't feel emotionally ready to come out here. But we felt we were ready, so we wanted to come out and show our support for the LGBT community and the Latino community and everyone else that lost someone that night.
All over walls and cards and little mementos left by people struggling to figure out what their connection is to a place like this, even as I'm struggling to figure out what my connection is to a place like this. But one person said it perfectly. I knew none of you. I miss all of you. Yesterday on a hot day in Orlando, we spent some time with Amanda Grau, Brian Anthony Alvear, and Terry DiCarlo at the GLBT Center of Central Florida. Lots of healing, lots of love, and lots of questions.
It's very tough. It's been a tough year for my fiance and my family as well.
What's it like to have an experience suddenly that for a period of time like this past year really seems close to defining you? You know, it's like right there ready to spill out of you, either one of you.
It's hard to live with this experience every day, you know, going through the nightmares, the flashbacks, and so that makes it more difficult. And but to know, to have especially my fiance Elizabeth that's there with me at the house and to keep me calm and sane, as well as my family, they do tend to make it a lot easier in their love and their support with that.
And for you?
For me, it's a sense of overwhelming loss because my sister was such an important part of my children's lives. She was like a super aunt. She had them like almost every other weekend. So that aspect, especially my youngest daughter looks just like her when she was my sister's age. So just that constant reminder of, oh, they're not going to get a card, or she's not going to come over to take them shopping or to the mall or to the movies. That part of it is very, very difficult.
What do the kids say?
They remember so fondly. My kids are amazing. People tend to forget how strong kids can be. 3 weeks ago, my daughter actually wore her Amanda Memorial shirt under her school shirt. And when she got home, she wanted to get in bed and like watch wrestling or something. And I was like, oh, and she took her shirt off and she was wearing it. She was like, oh, I wanted to think about Amanda today. I woke up thinking about her, so I put the shirt on because it makes me feel close to her. And I mean, she's 9, so I was like, whoa, like that's really, you know, touching. And the fact that she's thinking about it, but it's not a sad thinking about it, is what I really like. They, you know, the memories of their aunt are very happy in their minds, and I like that.
What was targeted a year ago here? People talk about terrorism, targeting something.
I will go till my dying day that this was an attack on the LGBT community. I will stick with that. And that is my opinion. Okay? There are others, the PD and other people have theirs. I will till I am put in the ground or my ashes are spewn somewhere that this was an attack on the LGBT community. Simple as that.
I agree. I think it was an attack on the LGBT community because someone wasn't comfortable in their own skin and they didn't know a way to get it out and try to be comfortable. So instead of trying to fix themselves, they lashed out at everybody else that could be open and could be happy and could dance freely. And it's a shame. You know, people like that need help.
I totally agree with them, but also I think it was also a terrorist attack as well. Being trapped in the bathroom for over 3 hours with him, he stated that he wanted all of us to stop bombing their women and children from their country and stuff. So I definitely do agree with these gentlemen that it is an attack on the LGBT as well as a terrorist attack as well.
Everybody knows that sense of when you're dancing, your whole body and spirit and heart and everything is just involved in, you know, that. And then to go from that to some of the things you've described, I just don't know.
I still keep dancing because it makes me feel good inside. It lets me in that moment be free and be myself and be free with my soon-to-be wife and friends and stuff like that. It's just a joy that brings into my life. And also being as a Latin woman too, we love to dance. So, yes.
What is the factor that most explains why you're alive?
First and foremost, God. He definitely was protecting me that night. I think just holding on in the bathroom, trying to be strong, knowing that I needed to get back to my fiance and our daughter and to get back to my family. And I think just that image in my mind kept me strong, being trapped in the bathroom and knowing that I needed to get back to my family.
You haven't been back there, right?
No, I have not been back to the Paul site. I will be back there tomorrow for the first time. I had lost my friend Chris Sanfelice, and I made a promise to him that I would be strong enough to come back in a year.
What is it that keeps you from going there? What is it that pushes? What's that wind feel like?
Fear, scared. I have nightmares of wondering when I do go there, is somebody going to come back and finish their job and get me? That's what I fear. But again, with my fiance and my family going tomorrow, they're going to be there in support. So it's going to help a lot.
I saw something written on the wall that blew me away. Didn't stand out. It wasn't big. It was probably about that big. It was I knew none of you. I miss all of you.
This tragedy, 365 days ago today, there was no straight, gay, black, white, red, yellow, Muslim, Catholic, Baptist here in Orlando. It was just Orlando. we had here at the center, by the time now I was down at the site, my board president, by the time he got here, there were already people standing outside this building with candles, and the front steps were loaded with flowers. And he got here at 5:30 in the morning, and they were already loaded up. By the time he opened the door, within 3 hours, there was over 600 people in this building. This affected all of Orlando. We're lighting up a display next door tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. It was built by a family, husband and wife, their 13-year-old son, their 8-year-old daughter, their grandparents. They had no connection to Pulse. They did not know anybody in the club. They had never been to Pulse. It took them a year to build this. It's incredible. And that was their way of healing, because they were hurt. They were from Orlando, and they were hurt. And it was just all of Orlando standing together, and it affected our whole city.
Did you attempt to find out what the last moments of your sister's life were like?
Sort of. I don't really ask a lot of questions, but fortunately, we've had a lot of people that her friend Brian spoke to her like right before she passed, like when she went into the bathroom. Amanda was amazing. I miss her every day. I'm so sad she's gone, but the way she went, I'm very proud. Like, Mercedes, her best friend who died with her as well, who might as well have been my other little sister, they've been friends for like 12 years, was paying their tab at the bar when all the shooting started, and everyone like kind of ran for it, and Amanda went to go get Mercedes, which is the kind of person she was. Like, she didn't make it out and come back in or anything like that, but the fact that her thought was, let me get my friend real quick, and then we'll get out. There aren't a lot of people like that, and I love that my sister was like that, and that's who she was, and it makes me really, really proud. And I'm sad they're both gone, but the fact that so many people were taken, were alone, and she was found with her best friend, it gives me a little bit of solace. I mean, it makes me a little happy, at least, that she didn't go alone.
Worst day, worst week, worst month of the last 365?
Tomorrow. Worst day of my life. For sure. It's going to be a very hard day for everyone, for the community, for the people that lost their loved ones that day, and also for families of survivors as well, because of that night as well. You know, nobody knew who was going to survive that night or come out, you know, alive or what. But I think it's very important that everybody is coming together as a community and to be around one another and to support each and every person that is going to be there tomorrow. Because like these gentlemen said too, Orlando was hit hard a year ago. So was Tampa and St. Pete. I mean, you can just see all the vigils and everyone just tears flowing. And not only that, also you can see other cities and stuff that also came together. And, you know, just the amount of support and that was pouring in, it was truly amazing how everybody came together as a unity, as one.
Terry, what's the wisdom of Orlando for the rest of the world?
The thing about us here in Orlando, with our great leaders, our we were talking, all our LGBT organizations and elected officials were friends beforehand. So we had each other's cell phone numbers. I have the mayor's cell phone number. Every LGBT organization knows they can come stand in my office or call me in the middle of the night if they have something going on. So when this happened, it was almost like activating the tree, the call tree. And everybody rallied to action, and everybody knew their position on what to do.
Is there it's a year short, long, whatever you want to describe it. Do you feel like inside there's a place you have to get to, something you still need to say, some feeling you still need to have to make progress here?
I just want to let people know, even though this tragedy happened, I don't want people to fear of who they are. Whether you're gay, straight, purple, blue, it don't matter. Be you. Be who you are. Love yourself and be the person that you want to be.
So you've made it all the way, or you still have some ways to go?
I'm learning as I go. That's what I can honestly say. So these past few months, I'm coming out on my own to, I go to bars with my fiance and friends. I've gone to a couple clubs. I've even spoken at Flamingo Resort, which is in St. Pete, for them. So I am coming out of my shell since that night.
I mean, I hope my job's not done. I want to get to a point where anyone can walk up to someone and give somebody a hug and people aren't afraid. And I mean, from now on, it's kind of made me want to be someone that hopefully can come across and teach people to be more accepting and pass that down to the younger generation, because that's the most important part, is that we need to learn from what happened and try to get past it and make sure we get to a place that it never happens again, which will take decades. Like Terry said, unfortunately, we're not at a place right now where we can't fear stuff like this happening, but we can slap it in the face by still being us and still doing what we do and having our flags held up super high and going out and dancing and just being ourselves.
You've taught us a lot.
Ryan Anthony Alvear is the brother of Amanda Alvear, who was killed during the attack at the Pulse nightclub a year ago. Founder of hashtag Hugs Not Hate, Amanda Grau, survivor of the attack at the Pulse Club, and Terry DiCarlo, executive director, the GLBT Center of Central Florida. Criticism of the Orlando Police Department's response to the attack at the Pulse nightclub began immediately. A headline at the Los Angeles Times, published less than 24 hours later, read, "Police face questions about delayed response to Orlando shooting." There was a 30-minute window between 2:20 a.m. when the first round of shooting stopped and 2:50 a.m. when the perpetrator, Omar Mateen, claimed in a call with crisis negotiators to have bombs. Critics argue the OPD should have moved in during that window. Officials with the department say it was at that time when the situation changed from an active shooter to a barricaded gunman with hostages situation, and that change in classification was critical. This window is the focus of one episode in a remarkable community service podcast series produced by member station WMFE called Life After Pulse. This episode was hosted and produced by Brendan Byrne.
So there's been quite a bit of controversy and criticism over the law enforcement's reaction to the Pulse nightclub shooting. For one, digging into the timeline, as we have done here, there's quite a bit of time where officers weren't interacting with the shooter at the time. So when the shots were first fired at 2:02, an extra-duty police officer was the only one there and was kind of flushed out. And it wasn't until a few minutes later before they were able to receive some backup and go in. And by 2:18, so about 16 minutes after the first shots were fired, Omar Mateen, the shooter, had holed himself up in a restroom on the west side of the club and remained there until SWAT breached the exterior wall at about 5 o'clock. So there's been some criticism as to why the police didn't approach him any earlier than that, and it was a hostage situation for so long.
Here's the audio from the 911 call, which took place at 4:19 a.m. This is 2 hours later, and the 911 call basically says the predicament of the police straight out.
"We are in the bathroom in Pulse. There's two people in here that are about to die. There's four already dead. Someone needs to come in here now."
"Listen, I understand. I understand. And I know you're scared. We have help coming to you, okay? You're in the bathroom.
We've been in here.
I understand. They have to secure the scene, okay?
Can they send someone in here? These two people are going to bleed out. Four is going to turn into six if someone doesn't come in here."
"Okay, and you're in the restroom?"
"Yes."
See, that's the amazing thing. We have to secure the location. We need to rescue people is what we need to do. And how have investigators reconciled this secure the scene language from go in there and get them before they die?
Well, when you talk to the Orlando Police Chief, John Mina, and the SWAT captain, they didn't want to approach because Mateen had the tactical advantage. It was a very, very small location where they were working from. There were two restrooms where there were hostages and one very small hallway in between, and they didn't know where Mateen was. So that is what they said is the reason that they didn't go in. He had the advantage. Everyone was at risk. And at 2:50, when he did talk to 911 folks and crisis negotiators, he did say that he had bombs and he was planning on blowing the place up, or he was planning on putting vests on hostages, which really kind of complicated the situation for those responders.
Here in this statement from Orlando Police Chief John Mina, you can hear the predicament of the Orlando police. He says it straight out.
Once that door would have opened, I'm sure he would have opened fire on our officers, and our officers, trying to protect their lives, would have had to return fire into that small bathroom area, putting the hostages at grave risk.
I can't tell if he's rationalizing or if he's just explaining protocol.
Well, in this particular case, there was long durations of no shooting. They didn't know who he was at first. If you listen to some of the early 911 calls from the night, they're trying to even figure out what he looks like. It's a very chaotic scene, very small scene. There's lots of mirrors. It's dark. There's lights. They don't know who he is. So it was a much different situation than a traditional active shooting situation, which is what Mina told me and what also other folks that have been in this leadership position, police leadership position, have told me as well.
Captain Mark Canty says some things here, and I'm assuming he's speaking to you here.
Mm-hmm, yes.
That are really confusing to me. Let's listen.
To try to walk someone out of that bathroom, the south bathroom as we call it, when he's in that north bathroom, there is no safe way to put officers in a position where they can cover people as they're coming out. And now we don't know if these people are, if they can walk, if they're wounded. So now you're trying to put, you know, multiple SWAT officers with, you know, 10 to 15 wounded people or scared people. And now you're trying to walk them down a 5-foot hallway where someone, they know someone was just shooting. That's very difficult.
But difficult, that's your job. I mean, again, get in there and save the hostages. Easy for me to say, but what's the response?
That's been the critical thinking from some of the folks that have remained skeptical as to the official reason why they didn't go in. And you're right. It's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback this from here and not being in there. But in the last 2 weeks, the Orlando Police Department released body camera footage showing the entrance to the club and the standoff with Mateen. And it is very confusing and it's very chaotic in there. And you can hear that the folks on the dispatchers are saying, you guys might want to get out of there. He's got a, you know, a high powered rifle. And the police stood their ground. They stood there outside of that door. They just did not get that order to go in. And that's where the criticism comes from, is that leadership saying, why didn't leadership say go in and go after the shooter as you would in a normal active shooter situation?
Chris Gronick is someone who can Monday morning quarterback. Yes. He's a former SWAT officer and a police tactic expert who works on security as a consultant. He defends the police, but he also says that this was an unusual situation.
The guy already demonstrated a propensity of violence that he was going to kill people because he already started. They had text messages that people were bleeding out. You can't just say, IQ, touch my shoe, I'm going to barricade myself, you know, please talk me out of this, when you have innocent victims bleeding out. That's why that's BS.
A year later, are there any regrets, things that would have been done differently, anything like that?
When I talked to Chief Mina, no. I asked him if there's anything that he would have changed that night. He said there were a few things, you know, maybe the way that we handled the media, maybe certain personnel. But no, the tactics did not change. I even asked him, I said, does this change your protocol and how you approach a situation like this before? And he said, absolutely not. They would do the same thing. And both Chief Mina and Captain Canty stand by the response that evening.
Brendan Byrne, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brendan Byrne is a reporter with Bimmer Station WMFE in Orlando. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckleberry. Over the weekend, Puerto Rico went to the polls to go on record whether to turn the territory into the 51st state or whether to stay a territory. When the votes were tallied on Sunday, it looked like a resounding win for statehood, roughly 97% supporting incorporation, but the main opposition parties boycotting the vote meant only 23% of registered voters actually turned out.
While Governor Ricardo Rossello, a major statehood supporter, is expected to try and push ahead into the union, many are prepared to question the legitimacy of this mandate. Where does it leave the economically beleaguered island? Danica Coto is a reporter and editor for the Associated Press based in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Clearly, the governor's pro-statehood party is claiming this as a huge win. Governor Ricardo Rossello is traveling to Washington, D.C. to present the results to Congress. And late last night, he vowed to push through the results through Congress. Many people say that it will likely not go anywhere, given that Republicans control Congress and that Puerto Rican usually leans to the Democratic Party.
So that would be the reason for opposing it, that it brings more Democrats into the electorate?
I think many believe that, yes. They would not want two senators and five additional representatives who are more likely to vote along Democratic lines. But I think others here who oppose the vote say, well, we would lose, you know, the island's cultural identity. We would lose the language. We would lose our Olympic team, our beauty queen contest. So there's a lot of sentiments flying back and forth in Puerto Rico today. And I think the headline of the local paper today best summed it up. It said, everyone claims they're a winner.
But that's really the problem, that the difficulties of Puerto Rico have come from this ambiguous status. And is statehood the only way to really get at some of the serious problems that are, if you do the math, almost impossible to imagine fixing under the current situation?
I mean, I think many economists believe that the what they say is the unequal treatment from the U.S. government to Puerto Rico has contributed greatly to the economic crisis. Puerto Rico is still mired in a 10-year recession. There's a 12% unemployment rate, and almost 500,000 Puerto Ricans have fled to the U.S. mainland. So as a result of its territorial status, Puerto Rico does not pay U.S. federal income tax, but it does pay Social Security and Medicare and local taxes, but it receives less federal funding than U.S. states. So economists say that this inequality has contributed in part to the crisis.
How do people in Puerto Rico see this American federal government treatment of the island?
Those who oppose statehood say, well, whatever benefits Puerto Rico might gain in terms of getting, you know, additional federal revenues would be offset by Puerto Rico having to pay millions in federal taxes. So the opposing party has proposed more freedom for trade for Puerto Rico and, you know, more economic incentives to help offset this inequality. But I think across party lines, everybody agrees that Puerto Rico should be allowed to vote in presidential elections and should receive more federal funding, given that it pays a lot of times the same in taxes as U.S. states do.
You said a moment ago, everyone's a winner, but nobody's a winner like Governor Ricardo Rossello. Does he envision his role, if things go according to plan, as the custodian leader of Puerto Rico as this transition takes place, if indeed it does?
I would think so. I mean, he ran on the pledge to hold a referendum and to make Puerto Rico the 51st state. That was his top campaign promise. And a lot of people, I believe, voted for him on that issue alone. So he's taking this win, you know, 97% of the vote for statehood. He's taking that win, what he says is a win to Congress.
Danica Coto is a reporter and editor for the Associated Press based in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Danica, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
June 12th is a red letter day on the calendar for another reason. 50 years ago today, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Loving versus Virginia, ruled that all laws criminalizing interracial marriage were unconstitutional. The couple behind that decision were Mildred Loving, a black and Native American woman, and her childhood sweetheart, Richard Loving, who was white. They were married in 1958 in Washington, D.C., but when the newlyweds returned to their home state of Virginia, they were arrested under that state's law, which banned interracial marriage, sex, and cohabitation. Yes, that happened in America. At one point, at least 41 states had racial purity laws on the books, making interracial love and marriage a crime until the Supreme Court struck them down. Jamie Floyd is an attorney, legal analyst here at WNYC, and the local host of All Things Considered. Her parents were married in 1956, 11 years before the Loving decision, and she joins me now to talk about the 50th anniversary, the decision's effect on her life, and a new project she's launching today on love, race, and identity in Trump's America.
Obviously, these relationships have been going on since colonial times in places, perhaps most of all, like Virginia. The Lovings themselves grew up in a small rural hamlet. They lived in Central Point, and it's way out. I mean, you have to drive a long way. It's an unincorporated part of Virginia, and it has a history, John, of race mixing. These two were childhood sweethearts. They didn't even really think they were doing anything wrong. Most of Richard's friends were mixed-race people. His best friend was Mildred's brother. She was Black and Native American, but in the Jim Crow South, she was a Negro. And he was a white guy. He drag raced cars. He was a brick mason by day. And they decided they wanted to get married. Now, they couldn't get married in Virginia, so they went off to Washington, D.C. to do it. But then they came home to live with their friends and their family. And pretty much right away, the newlyweds were arrested. They got married in 58. And in early 1959, the cops burst in to their bedroom in the middle of the night. And when Mildred pointed up at their marriage license, the sheriff said, "That's no good here," and hauled the couple off to jail, Mildred too, and they were tried and convicted of a felony.
And so that arrest became a cry throughout the entire moral majority political debates of the 1980s and 1990s. So this had a huge impact, even though we don't remember the decision. We don't talk about the decision as knowledgeably as you do.
Well, that's right. I mean, the court recognizes the fundamental right to marry in this decision, the right to privacy in your bedroom. And this becomes, you're correct, the cry of the right. But when it comes to the oppressed that the Constitution is supposed to protect, say African Americans or gay Americans, there's a long fight, a journey to the realization and the recognition of those rights for all Americans.
Isn't it ironic that the cases that legalized gay marriage revisit the exact same issues?
They do revisit the exact same issues, though the gay marriage decision, Obergefell, in 2015, almost 50 years later, doesn't rely entirely on Loving. They rely on a bunch of different cases, civil rights cases for sure. But I think, John, Loving was the cultural precedent for the gay marriage decision. Mm-hmm. It opened the hearts and minds of the justices to recognize gay marriage as a fundamental right for all Americans.
How did your parents talk about this decision?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because the Lovings were not activists. They weren't marching on Washington. They were very simple people who just wanted to live their lives in rural Virginia. But my parents were activists, and I was raised on a steady diet of civil rights litigation and cases. I knew who Justice Thurgood Marshall was, and I knew who the lawyer Thurgood Marshall was before that. And I knew all about the Loving decision. My parents were married 2 years before the Lovings. When they were married, even more states had these insidious laws. It was difficult for my parents to get the blood test required by law to allow them to be married. So my parents traveled to three different states before they could find a doctor with the courage to violate that law. And they did find the doctor in Chicago, and they were married in Chicago, and they suffered untold discrimination. I cannot tell you. I mean, my mother, the white person in the relationship, was fired from jobs when her employers would find out she was married to a Black person. But they decided, we're going to New York, and here we are.
Hmm.
But New York was a tough place. I mean, it is not, you know, you think New York, progressive, free, kumbaya, not so. There weren't very many interracial couples in the 1960s.
Yeah, what population? What population did this have an impact on back in the 1960s?
Well, even now, John, as the explosion in multiracial and interracial families, couples, and adoptions occurs, even now, the Black-white dating relationship and marital relationship is still the slowest growing relationship.
you call this the Other Box Project.
Yeah. Why is it an Other Box Project? First of all, I've been checking that other box my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to check that box anymore. I want to not be perceived in this society as other than.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many projects, tributes, books, efforts out there about the Lovings and even about multiracialism.
Mm-hmm.
This is an effort to bring them together, to create a constructive conversation that moves us forward as a nation. With Loving, we had a court case, but we'd already had centuries of race mixing in the bedroom, in our neighborhoods, in our kitchens, in our friendship circles. So it was precisely the reverse. Now, we still have proms that don't allow interracial couples. We still have judges that won't officiate at interracial marriages. So very occasionally, we have to step in with the law. But this isn't about the law as much as it is about love and society. And it's not about the courts as much as it is about us. And I say that as somebody who loves the law.
Right.
And believes in the Constitution. But I think the Constitution's done its work in this realm.
Jamie Floyd, host of All Things Considered, WNYC legal analyst and creator, curator of the Other Box Project. Thank you so much for a fascinating discussion.
Folks who are interested can check it out at otherboxproject.org.
Remember that the Other Box Project on Love, Race, and Identity, it launches tonight at New York City's Green Space. We return now to the year after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida. Orlando, emotionally strong and prepared for the worst terrorist mass shooting in U.S. history, as people in the community pulled together in love and caring, while at the same time law enforcement may not have been as prepared. And here's a fascinating detail. For many families of those killed or wounded at Pulse, a language barrier magnified the terror and uncertainty of that night. With only 6 interpreters at Orlando Regional Medical Center and a shortage of Spanish speakers at the 911 call center, non-English speakers were dependent on bilingual friends, family members, and volunteers to determine whether their loved ones had survived. The city has discovered a serious gap in Spanish-speaking staff for mental health resources as well. Crystal Chavez is a reporter with WMFE in Orlando. She spoke to some of the people who witnessed the struggle of non-English speakers in the aftermath of the shooting.
From the time it started, people were rushed to Orlando Regional Medical Center. And many of these people, it was Latin night, were Latin or African American, and many of them spoke English, the club goers themselves. There were a handful that needed interpreters at the hospital. A couple of them were in critical condition. So that was where the hospital puts its interpreters. Where the need was in the family room, where you had families that are watching the news, or watching CNN, they're hearing NPR, and they're trying to get word on their loved one, and they talk about the waiting and the waiting. And if you knew English, you had an upper hand. And there are stories about people having to translate for other family members, and just this chaos in the family room and this waiting and not knowing the language, it just sounds like a scary situation.
And in a situation like this, if you're missing one piece of information, it could be gibberish. And having someone say over and over again, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, can be, magnifying the trauma.
Even more than that, sometimes people would hear a name on a list, but they didn't know if that list meant they're in the hospital or they're not in the hospital or if they're dead.
So what does the community, in terms of taking lessons from this, try to do to think about this?
Well, right away, some community members started seeing who the crying moms and dads were, and they created organically this group called Proyecto Somos Orlando. We are Orlando Project. And they immediately started just getting a website up, telling people where they can find resources in town in Spanish, Hispanic family counseling. They have bilingual counselors. So in that way, these new organizations sprung up that really weren't there before to serve people at the intersection of Latino and LGBT.
And let's hear for a moment some of the individuals who are directly involved in this language barrier problem. Here's someone who was really talking about the very, very beginnings of what happened a year ago.
They didn't have anyone when this all started who could translate to those who didn't understand. They were lost. It was, well, like a movie.
That woman's voice you're hearing, she lost her cousin who was like a brother to her. And she's the person in the family, this family's from Puerto Rico, and she's the one that had the task of going and getting the information. And she talks about being frustrated with the police, being frustrated with the hospital officials, and then having to be the message relayer to the family. His mom flies over from Puerto Rico. The confirmation of his death happens while the mom is flying over here. And now Lolly has to tell the mom. And so she meets the mom at the airport, and she said she knew right away from the look on her face.
Hmm. Here's another individual who describes just how it can feel like being buried alive when there's a communication difficulty on top of the fear and trauma of an event like what happened a year ago.
You don't always have to be strong. If there's a moment when the situation gets too overwhelming, stop, breathe, and when you're ready for that step to get help, we're available, as are many other agencies in the area.
He was also a Pulse survivor. He was in the outside bar area mingling when all of this happened. And he's still seeing a therapist to this day. He talks about that every week. He sees his therapist. And he's also saying that that there are going to be a lot of triggers today on the one-year anniversary, some of these big tributes. And he's saying that the Pulse survivors, everybody grieves and handles this on their own way. Some people want to stay home today and just reflect quietly. Some people want to be around others and feel that love. And he's just saying when you see a trigger, stop and take care. Self-care is important.
Tell me about Brandon.
Brandon owns a gay bar named Savoy, and it's not this big club like Pulse, but it's more laid back. But initially, right after the attack, people were scared and on edge, so he had security in the first few weeks. After a fast forward to a year later, he doesn't have that security. He's like, we can't afford it. And it doesn't come cheap. But everyone he talks about is still very aware of their surroundings. They look at the exits.
See something, say something. You hear that all the time. And people do, like, you know, we don't allow backpacks in here anymore for obvious reasons, but we had someone bring one in and set it down. Well, he was a regular. I knew him personally, but, you know, somebody saw it and immediately alerted the bartender and staff. So, you know, people are definitely more vigilant and more aware, I think, now.
So many people we've talked to who, you know, wonder why they're alive, who are asking the questions why their brother or sister had to die, and Orlando Torres is just like so many of them.
No matter what, everybody has a number. We don't know it. In history, everybody has a number. It wasn't my number that night, you know. So you're not going to stop living life. You're not going to live in a shell. Thank God it's building back up. People are accepting what transpired and taking a chance, you know, and coming out.
How have you thought about this?
Right. So he says that it's building back up. The crowds are building back up. People are starting to feel safe enough to go out. Not everyone. There's some survivors who everyone says will stay in their apartment, haven't really got out much. But then you have Orlando Torres, who is determined not to let this stop him from celebrating birthdays and family events and being at the club where he feels he can be mostly himself. You don't always get that kind of acceptance in work or school if you're a member of the LGBT community. He used to be a club promoter for Latin Nights at Pulse, and he was a paid promoter. But now he kind of promotes for the other Latin Nights that have sprung up around town to kind of take up Latin Night. Some other clubs are doing that. What is a real story no one's talking about is the hip-hop nights that were frequented by the Black community. Those really haven't started up again in the way Latin Nights have.
Crystal Chavez is a reporter at WMFE right here in Orlando.
Thank you for having me.
Since the shooting, Orlando Regional Medical Center has hired many more Spanish interpreters, and hospital plans to have them wear vests, clearly identifying them as Spanish speakers. You can hear more from Crystal's story or any other part from a pair of special podcasts produced by WMFE, one in Spanish, Orlando Un Año Después, and one in English, Life After Pulse.
Find them at WMFEindepth.org/podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So many lessons about humanity and the power of love from down here in Orlando, Florida.
Keep dancing, Orlando, and we're not going to let any terrorists prevent us from enjoying what we love doing as human beings. Whatever sexual orientations we have or religion belief, we are going to still do what we enjoy doing, and we're not going to let them win.
I think that's my favorite lesson from Orlando Torres, a Latin night party promoter, one of the many people heard on our show today. A huge thanks to the staff at WMFE for having us here and for teaching us the power of public radio at the local community level. As always, thanks to you so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.